Carol Nolte, who is on the staff here and has lived in New Guinea, spoke to me about dreams, and she said something I want to share with you. She said, there they divide dreams. They take them very seriously. They divide dreams into something-nothing dreams, you know, sort of as fragments, and other dreams that they call dreams true. And I'm going to be talking about dreams true, that is, significant dreams, the kind of dreams that can make a difference in your life. And again, I'll say, I'll summarize for those who haven't been here just quickly why it's important to dream, because it's like a mirror reflecting what? The
unconscious.
And I've drawn a diagram a little better this time, I think, of what our psyche is like. I'll try to make it so everybody can see. There's this little thing up there, that's the ego, you know, that's not egoism, but the ego, the self, part of the self that deals with the world. When somebody says, "What? Who are you?" you'll say, "My name," that's your name, and your occupation, where you live. It's the kind of thing you exchange over the dinner table. And up here is a consciousness, that's how you direct your life. But as I said, that's only about one-fifth, and down here is four-fifths. All this is unconscious, and all this can't be known. And up here at the first level, which is easily known, is the personal unconscious. See, and that can be made known very easily, even without dreaming. I think some of that's available just when you look inside, and you know, some of the things that you repress or the things that you are aware of on a deeper level. On the next layer is the collective unconscious, and that's Jung's term specifically. Freud, for instance, used only the personal unconscious, whereas, and he said all the things were sexual in there, and many of them are. But here you have this whole creative reservoir. Here, creativity and all the archetypes are lodged, and they can come up in dreams, and it's this that you want to tap in dreams, because there's all the power. It's really like a powerhouse. And then way down here is what they call the psychoid level, which you hardly ever reach. That's sort of the lowest level. Only very, very differentiated people ever reach that in very, very significant dreams. It's the borderline. It's that area that is the borderline between the physical and the psychic. And the whole, all the archetypes are contained in myths. And myths and fairy tales contain the same things we'll be talking about in dreams. So when you read fairy tales and myths, they contain the same images. And archetypes are defined as primordial images, that is, filled with energy. There are things like the cross, and then I will give you specific things for individuals. All the symbols that have meaning for us. Our archetypes, and as I will talk, I'll give you examples of them. But first I want to say that they are not easily available. They're not something you can label. You know, we tend to talk about it in our circles. Oh, the wise old man, the wise old woman you'll see down there. That isn't really readily available. It's something that you learn to recognize as you dream. And in your dreams you would see an older person whom you don't know, who might be the wise old woman, or the wise old man, who usually has a lot of wisdom for you, the kind of wisdom that is contained in myths and in legends and in our religion. And somewhere I read today or yesterday that religion embodies the wisdom of the ages in symbols that are charged with energy. And so when you go to church and you see the cross and you bring to it something, you can unlock all that energy that's in there. Because Christ has put himself for us in there. And the cross is a shorthand way of, when you see it, it reminds you of all these things. And the more you bring to it, the more you get back. And so with all these symbols, they're charged with energy. And in some of your dreams, you will see some of these symbols as you keep track of them. And they too are charged with energy, and they can almost transform your life. Another very important thing is that some dreams, the significant dreams, the dreams true that I talked about, have this aura of light and warmth, and it's just wonderful. You wake up and you think you've been in heaven. And again, heaven is an archetypal image for all that is just perfect, perfection, really, wonderful. So if you have a dream that's suffused with a lot of bright light, it probably is a significant one. Sometimes the dreams are very ritualistic. I have a recurring one where my minister dies and is buried, then is resurrected, arises and is resurrected. That's a perfect recapitulation of the Easter story. And I thought, at first I was kind of worried, I thought it was about the minister. Well, most dreams are significant, are about your inner self, and it was my inner spiritual life that, or my soul that, you know, would go into the dark night and be resurrected again, rebirth. Many, many dreams are of rebirth, like the myth of Jonah, or the story of Jonah, I don't know if you call it a myth, being swallowed in the belly of the whale is a story of rebirth. He has to die and then be resurrected. He also prefigures Christ. But psychologically, it's a story of rebirth. So whenever you're swallowed up in something and come out again, or part of you comes out again or something, it often is a symbol of rebirth and a very significant dream true. A very, very important thing about archetypes is that they're charged with energy, both positive and negative. And I'll give you some specifics here now. You have male and female images that will float up in one form or another, and we have given them names, general names, that you will recognize. Now there's Adam and Eve that will come up. Now you may not dream of Adam as Adam, but it will be a primitive man, maybe a caveman. We call it Adam, you know, we label it Adam. That would be an archetype. But if you dreamt of a person who is living in the jungle in primitive conditions, if it's a man, it would represent Adam. If it was a woman, it would represent Eve. On the negative side, and I quarrel with this a little bit, you'd have a warlock or a witch, see? I don't know that they're exactly the opposite, but that's a technical point. All I'm saying is that as you may dream of a positive primitive man, you could dream of an evil primitive person, which would be a witch or a warlock. A little higher level, you dream of a knight or a hero. And for the woman, it's the Amazon. It's the kind of person who goes out and conquers. The knight in shining armor, the knight on the white horse, the hero who conquers. Often a person in uniform, and for women, the Amazon, the person who, well, women's libbers love this now, I mean the person who can go out and deal with the world and conquer men and just get her way. Those are archetypes that can rise. On the negative side, you have a Don Juan, a man who just wants to conquer women for the really kind of fun of it, and for women, a prostitute. They're again not equivalents, but you see the negative side. She too serves men, but in a different way. Then you have the king. Now we're getting really, in a sense, this is a spiral that goes lower and lower, or higher and higher, whichever way you want to say it. You have the king and the queen, and many times you dream of a king and a queen together. That is a marvelous dream, because there's the archetype of the king and the queen united. And if they are together in a room or something, it means that you have united your masculine side and your feminine side on one of the highest levels possible. He calls that the mystical marriage. And then you have the Savior and the Virgin. This is somewhat colored by Catholic imagery, but the Virgin does stand for the highest feminine, what?
Ideal,
thank you. And the negative for both of those is the devil and a female devil. I couldn't think of a name for that. But you know what I mean. The king and savior now, the savior would be, in our culture, we would probably dream of Jesus or sometimes the Holy Spirit, maybe in the form of a dove. But in different cultures, the savior would be the whatever religion they were raised in, but it would still be the same archetype. That's what I'm saying. The savior is the savior. Now, I don't want to get into a religious controversy, but psychologically, it doesn't matter what name you give to it. Religiously, it does. But he's the person who can save you, who can transform you. And if you have a dream about the savior, you're probably being transformed, reborn. And it is certainly magnificent when you do dream that. That's usually suffused with a lot of light. And on probably the deepest level, you dream of the wise old man or the wise old woman appearing to you, sometimes very unknown, giving you a lot of advice, sometimes in a foreign language, sometimes very cryptically, like in an oracle. And they represent the wisdom of the ages that you have in your unconscious that comes up in the image of the wise old man or the wise old woman. And as I said jokingly the other day, when I go through my dreams that I have recorded over the years, I have marked in the margin if a wise old man or a wise old woman appeared. When a wise old woman appeared, I abbreviated to W-O-W, which is wow. So I looked at this dream the other day and I said, my, what is it? You know, wow, what is it? Well, it was, you know, a very serious woman giving me a brown stone. The stone often represents wisdom. Now, one other very important aspect are shapes and numbers as they appear. And what would you say that the number three would represent?
Trinity.
Yeah, that could be very well, the Trinity. And then four.
Earth.
Yeah. Or wholeness. He makes a lot out of the fact that a square room or the number four is an image, archetypal image of wholeness. And 10, which is in the Bible often mentioned quite a bit, is a very important number. So it's 7. 7 is a kind of magical number. And the same numbers that you see in the Bible many times reoccur in dreams. I don't know why, but they do. Also, they are very specific sometimes. And as I said before, in a dream there are kind of puns and allusions. And so when you dream of a number, especially if it's repeated, it probably has a very important significance. It may mean your age, it may mean the time of day, it may mean many different things, and it could be quite symbolic. As I said before, the cross is probably one of the greatest archetypal symbols that is charged with energy, which your consciousness can unlock and you can receive the energy back from it. So from all these archetypes in your dreams, you can receive energy back, and that's part of your growth and part of your recharging and part of your individuation. That's a word that Jung uses. Individuation. You become more what you were meant to be. When you were born, you had a destiny, and as you grow, you become more yourself in the process of individuation. And it's a kind of exciting growth because you keep going over the same ground over and over. You have to face the same problems over and over, but you're just at a little higher level as you become a little more conscious of what's going on inside yourself. And we all start on different levels, and we have different levels to which we will grow. But there's kind of an in-given destiny that we all have built into ourselves, where we are become most, where we have realized our potential. And I love to think of Holden as a place where we can grow and realize our potential almost to the maximum, because there's so many possibilities and so many marvelous people to stimulate us. If it's not too much, I want to throw out two or three more concepts for you. It's very important to realize that we, all of us, have the masculine and the feminine within us. Now, Jung has coined the term anima and animus. Anima is the female component in a man, and animus is the male component in a female woman. Now, when you fall in love, you have this image of the perfect man. We have more women here, so I'm going to start with that. You have the image of the perfect man or the ideal man in you, and you take this image, you project it onto the first man that you fall in love with. Oh, he's just marvelous. He rides on a shining horse. Everything he can do, he's perfect. Or he fits. But if he doesn't fit this image, see, this is what happens after a while. Suddenly you look at him and say, oh, my God, it's only John Jones. And he just doesn't fit the image. And then you fall out of love until you find somebody who fits the image pretty well. And then you get married. And then the whole thing starts all over again. And suddenly you wake up and you look at your husband and you say, golly, he doesn't fit the image either. But that's when you start having a real relationship, because nobody can fit this animus image perfectly. It's an archetype that you project. You have to take it back into yourself, recognize that it belongs to you, and look at the other person as he is and build a relationship like C.S. Lewis talks about, which has all the qualities of eros and friendship and affection, so that you have a really firm relationship. And then your marriage will hold through thick and thin. And I think it's really important for all of us to realize that it's just natural to fall in love by throwing this image on this man, and then at one point to look up and say, oh, it really doesn't fit. Of course, the same thing happens with a man. For a man, it is just about the same. He takes the anima image, the image of the perfect woman, and puts it on the woman he falls in love, and then sooner or later finds it doesn't fit, and either they fall in love and break up, or else if they're married, he has to pull back the energy and have to start making a relationship with the real girl he married. And it's kind of exciting, because you find that aspects of the archetype do fit, or else you would never have been attracted to this person, and there's part of the mystery. But it never fits perfectly. So that's where another really valuable tool is in your hands, where you can see that, especially for young people, it's important to realize that the anima is projected, or the animus is projected. Has anyone had this experience? Or? And then the last concept I want to throw out is the fact that we have within us the dark side or the shadow. Now, that is the side that we don't like to show people or own or even recognize. We may not even know that what our shadow is. And it's very hard to come to terms with it. Now, if you went to an analyst, a Jungian analyst, one of the first things he would try to do is to hold the mirror up to you. Another person has to do that, not a physical mirror, but hold the mirror up to you, so that you can recognize your own shadow. And that will come out in dreams very soon. That is more in the personal unconscious, actually. And the shadow appears, can be tapped by exercises. I could sort of, not hypnotize you, but I could say, now close your eyes and I'll lead you there, and then you imagine somebody, and the person you imagine could become the shadow if you direct the thing in the right way. But we usually feel we shouldn't do this when we just have an audience like this, but in a small work group we could try that sometime, where we have a directed meditation, and then you come in contact with your own shadow and you see what qualities you haven't owned in yourself. Because again, you will, it's like in a fairy tale, you will see this witch-like character. Why a witch is so fascinating? Because for women, the witch quality is part of their shadow. And in Hansel and Gretel, you know, she pushes them, when they push the witch into the oven, haven't you all exulted in that, getting rid of that witch in there? And, you know, it's like getting rid of anything ugly within yourself. Another way that you can find out about your shadow is if you dream of someone who is quite, of your own sex, who's threatening or dark and does some very unsavory things. That's not as good as finding out what it is you criticize in other people, especially when you gossip. Now there's light gossip and there's kind of heavy gossip, but when you really get worked up about somebody and, oh my, you know, you're really judging them a little bit, like he said, when we put a label on somebody, that's usually projecting our shadow. And then we close off the possibility of having a relationship. But what we're saying about this person is usually not wholly true of them. It's a lot, again, a projection of our own qualities that we don't want to see. And I'm sure you've all had experiences with that kind of situation. It's often also true that when you get terribly upset about something that you can't know why, it's kind of irrational. Some quality in you, you said, I didn't think I had it, that's not me. You lose your temper, you know. That's part of the shadow coming out. We all have it and we have to own it. And it's really good to be aware what in you, because everybody has a different kind of personality and also, of course, the opposite, then a different kind of shadow. And the main thrust of Jung's psychology and the thrust of all this is to remember that there are always opposites. Everything is balanced, not perfectly, but pulling in opposite directions. And you need to reconcile these opposites or tolerate the tension. And there's high and low and dark and light. There is good and bad, good and evil. Those things are all within you pulling in opposite directions. And these specific images pull in opposite directions as well. And when you dream, you sometimes can see how you're dreaming of two opposites. Something very ethereal and something very primitive. I'm wondering if any of you have examples or if you have any specific questions up till now, because I have a lot more I can say, but I don't want to go too fast. Has anybody had a wild dream or a dream true? Carol, I used your image. Dream true and dream something, nothing. Were you all here when I said that? In New Guinea, they label dreams as dream something, nothing.
That's a regular dream.
That's a regular dream, you know. And those are the snippets of yesterday. You know, like you go to a movie and you sort of rerun the movie in your dream or something. And then there's the dream true, which are the archetypes rising. And they're the kind I want you to write down if you're going to keep a dream diary. Yes?
What about when you dream of somebody that's been dead for a long time?
That's close to you, or
yeah, fairly
close. That probably means that unconsciously you've been thinking of it. Would depend what she meant to you, but often it is connected with your own awareness of your own death, which is both comforting and frightening, you see. It has two aspects. But if we believe that we will be reunited with those who have left before us, then dreaming of them means that we're thinking what will happen when it happens to us. Well, that could be a possibility.
What about a dream of flying? You yourself are flying.
Oh, uh-huh. That often means that you're reaching for some higher intellectual or spiritual levels. And as long as you don't fly too high or too near the sun, you do know that, what is it, myth?
Icarus.
Icarus, yes. Now there you see, I have a beautiful archetype. Flying is something humanity has wanted to do through the ages, and the myth of Icarus is beautifully illustrating why you must not fly too high, because you will fall into the sea. So flying may mean reaching for higher levels, but you must somehow remain rooted, or else you might fall in the sea.
What about the dream?
Yes. Go ahead.
Of falling.
That is, as we said last time, often in adolescence, a very typical dream associated with a rapid growth and anxiety. Yeah.
What does it mean, like, if you're being chased by someone, like in your dream, like something's after you and you're running from something?
Mm-hmm. Well, that could often be that you're lying in a funny position. That's a sort of something-nothing dream sometimes. It's also a little anxiety, but something is chasing you that could be your circulation is cut off, or especially, as I said, a train is coming towards you, you know, and you're lying with your leg up and you can't move. It could be real fear and real anxiety. It would depend on a specific dream. Yes?
When I was young, I used to dream about going to church and getting there and not having any shoes and socks on. Very inappropriately dressed. Does that have any significance?
Well, you're tying right in with a series of dreams that I've had over and over again. I'm going to church and I can't find my shoes and socks, precisely. Or sometimes I'm even in my bathing suit, or very inappropriately dressed. And I felt for myself, and maybe for you, it meant that sort of like you're not having the wedding garment, you're not prepared spiritually, psychologically for church. You're trying to go in there in an unprepared way.
I've often, as I was growing up in teenage years possibly, had the dream of when of being a tiny, tiny, tiny thing, and then being so big that all I could see was just thumbprint.
How beautiful. I had that experience too. I think that's fairly universal. Were you sick at the time?
I don't remember.
It has something to do with your blood pressure and your circulation. I don't know. It's a very common thing.
It is.
It's so scary. But I used to have it when I had fever.
I can't remember when I've had it, but I remember having it two or three times.
It's really weird. Yeah. You just disappear and then you go up. But it does have something to do with the heartbeat or the circulation.
Yeah.
Just Nancy?
What's the relationship between our fantasies and our dreams? Well, say our waking dreams and our sleeping dreams.
Oh, what's the relationship between waking dreams and sleeping dreams?
A lot.
Depending on how much you allow your consciousness or ego to die down. In your waking fantasies, if you just let it float along, you can sometimes have archetypal things arise, just like in dreams. We call that active imagination. And in analysis, they sometimes ask you to do this consciously. But you must let your ego not interfere. You know, you can't direct it. The other difference is that you can, you don't go as low. You don't really, still have conscious control when you are awake. The main advantage to a night dream is that you are dreamed. You really have no control whatsoever. And so that's why it's more, but it's very similar. Yes? You had a question?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What would be your reaction to a very close relative who had died previously? She mentioned an aunt. Would it be about the same as an aunt?
I think so. It depends on when and how you dreamt it and the circumstances, you see. I can't really answer that in general.
Well, I was thinking about my father who died 9 years ago now. Mm-hmm. I thought I was quite close to him.
Mm-hmm.
And I've dreamt about him a few times.
Mm-hmm.
And he seems so alive.
Yes. That would be a really significant dream. And he might represent to you, I don't know, but he might be the wise old man for you. See, he might be the archetype then. Not just your own father. But that would depend on the dream. maybe we can talk about it. Carol?
Yeah, I was going to ask, what, is there any significance to dreams that incorporate outside sounds, especially sounds or smells even in them?
Mm-hmm.
Many people have this experience with the alarm clock itself, but there are other things too.
Yes, I think those are a way to keep you asleep. You incorporate them,
uh-huh.
and thus you don't have to wake up.
Yeah.
I have observed that a baby will be getting restless, and it will make sucking movements and purr and go on sleeping.
Uh-huh.
So that sort of activity starts at an early age, and I think it continues forever. One way or another, because there's something in us that says, I want to keep curled up and asleep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How fixed are archetypes? Like, do they, evolve is a funny word, but do they change the way we do, like, as physical people, or do they keep up with, like, our cultural changes?
Hmm.
Yes.
The archetypes being primordial images and like images in myths and fairy tales are pretty unchanging. That's why these specific things like a king and knight and Amazon and queen and virgin and savior, these are images that are quite universal.
Are there theories as to why, say, the virgin is the ideal woman instead of the mother being the ideal woman?
Well, that will depend, some of that depends on the culture. And there is also the image of the great mother and the great father, which is often the wise old woman and the wise old man, see. Mm-hmm. It is colored by the culture, but not as much as you think, because they come from much deeper level. Yes?
Yeah, the dreams that, now there are, you were talking about dreams like something, nothing dreams, or mm-hmm. that don't mean anything. Like dreams that usually mean something, are they usually dreams that involve people?
Not necessarily.
Not necessarily?
No.
Like, is there a way you can tell the difference?
I think mostly experience, you see. I'll tell you two examples. I had a dream of, the one I started out with, you know, the spiral that ends in total freedom. There are no people in that, but it certainly spoke to me. But another example is I dreamt of a 6-foot, 3-inch ice cream cone that represented Christ's love. I thought that was really beautiful.
How did you know it represented Christ's love?
That's what it said. Somebody said that in the dream. Somebody said to me, Christ's love is like a 6-foot, 3-inch ice cream cone. Now you interpret that to me. Well, it's kind of fun because, you know, what is more wonderful than an ice cream cone? The joy kind of thing, you know. And it's you know, I mean, how long would it take you to eat that ice cream cone? It's almost the equivalent of infinity, isn't it? I mean, don't push the image too far, but you see, there were no people in that, all right? Now, how do you know the difference? I think your experience tells you. When you look at many dreams in your life, you'll see which ones jolt you, which ones startle you, and which ones you really remember, even without writing them down.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's one criterion. Yeah?
All
right.
I've had a series of dreams for about 2 years now, but I'll be reading like a scroll.
Mm-hmm.
Or I don't know if it's a scroll, but I'll just be reading something. I can't remember what I'm reading.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'll be reading it, and I just can't figure out what it is. I can understand it and comprehend it, but as soon as I read it, I forget it.
Ah.
And it's not in English either.
Ah.
While I'm reading, it's not in English. But while I'm reading, it seems to make all the sense in the world. I just have a great time reading it, mm-hmm. and then I just forget it right away.
Well, maybe you have to go back and dream it some more. Maybe one of these days a message will come through.
But I mean, does that mean anything? Or like when you're reading it, something like that?
I think it does. It's just that you're not ready yet, perhaps, for the message. I don't know. It's hard to say.
Pretty long scroll.
Is it possible to consciously beforehand, whether you do it in prayer or whether you do it in any other way, ask God to help you remember this, or to say, if I dream this dream tonight, or to control your dreams in many ways. This is one thing where it would be very helpful. I remember having a dream where I remembered in my sleep that I had to remember this particular part of it when I woke up, and sure enough, there was the first thing in my mind when I woke up. But also having a nightmare reoccurrence that I would ask God to please not let me dream before I went to sleep as a child. Mm-hmm. And those nights I wouldn't dream.
I think that would be very helpful. And I think it still would depend on your own desire to really remember or not remember. You see, I think we do realize that we always dream. It's a question of the remembering part. And that's where your petition would be answered if you were praying and asking that you don't remember it because you didn't want to remember it. You see, that would help suppress
your own control of the neural.
Yeah, you can, but you can't really... There is a book out that says you can control your dreams, and I forget, do you know the author too? Oh, well, and I feel that's like, trying to control the uncontrollable. It just can't be done, really.
Is it possible then, according to you, that God can speak in dreams to people?
I think yes, I think he certainly has in the Bible, but I don't presume that any one of us is quite up there. But maybe he does. I don't know. I have a thing about that.
I don't know if that's up there or just when you happen to be in positions where you need help drastically.
Yeah, well, I would think so. If you wish, you could say that all these messages is God speaking to you. I mean, you could, all these messages that you get is God speaking to you in a sense. But I like to leave it on the psychological level, you see, and then prayer being a different thing. It's, yes?
Is color important?
Yes, it can be. Some dreams are more colorful. I remember saying, I dreamt this in Technicolor, and it's just a vivid, vivid image. It's like a painting. Have any of you had this experience? And other dreams are just sort of abstract or nondescript. There are some colors that have symbolic value, and I might as well have had this as my next thing. So. In general, red and black represent blood and death, often also life force. I mean, red color is passion, life force. White is purity. Blue, the color of Mary, as well as color associated with thinking. Your rational function. So if you dreamt of somebody wearing a blue and white robe, he would be thinking pure thoughts, spiritual thoughts perhaps. Yellow and gold often represent intuition. This is in Jungian terms. And, or something very precious metal or something. Is usually gold or yellow. The green is both hope and the spring, the color of spring, new life, which is different from the red. And what have I left out? Purple. Purple is probably the Advent color. I don't know. Yeah, I think yellow, white, blue, red, orange. Yeah. Well, I'm talking about primary colors. Otherwise, you get into all these shades of color.
Aren't these pretty much cultural?
Yes.
Wouldn't,
well, yeah, we're white, talking now of our cultural associations. Yeah. And I'm talking even more specifically of Jungian associations. Because if you're here next week, I'll be talking about psychological types. And for those of you who are leaving, I'll just give you a quick rundown. There's thinking and feeling and intuition and sensation. And the colors associated with those are thinking blue, feeling red, intuition orange, or yellow, and sensation green. But we'll go into that more. These are just symbolic colors. They're different from the liturgical colors. And I think the liturgical colors have a real value because they're also kind of universal. And there's a lot of discussion on certain levels as to what these colors mean. But again, for you, in your particular dream, you will know when you're dreaming constantly of something blue and white, or the priest is wearing yellow and white robes, or you have on a red, bright red sweater and skirt, you begin to see that they have a certain meaning, and they may be universal or they may be more specific for you. Again, let's say you had bought a special red sweater and you dreamt about that red sweater, it would have a very different meaning than if you dreamt of a banner that had red and black squares, you see. So it depends on your own.
I've never dreamed of anything in color. What does that indicate?
It's all that you have a black and white TV. Dream TV, I mean. Yeah?
Did I hear you say that there is a significance to your body chemistry has a significant effect on dreams?
I think so.
Such as consuming a number of calories before you go to bed?
Well, I think so. I think that would end in a sort of something-nothing dream. That was a little unpleasant, you know. The chances are that you'll dream your more significant dreams if you haven't eaten too heavily and you're sleeping not under the influence of alcohol. I think alcohol suppresses dreams, I'm not sure. What is your experience in that, Jim?
No, I don't know about
it. I'm sorry, I mean...
Yeah.
No, I didn't mean that. I didn't mean...
It was interesting to me in respect to the concept of idea control dreams. I can predict when I'm going to have some really deep dreams, and that's when I eat routinely, don't drink anything, go to bed absolutely happy. The dream might be horrible, but what happens is my body and mind at its best and its most normal and its most healthy state allows the gates to open.
Yeah.
And that's the only thing I can control. But yeah, if I drink the night before, I don't drink. Good reason for not drinking.
That's right. Yes.
But if you have nightmares, you're going to scare a lot of people and drink. It gives me a great deal of pleasure to have a glass of wine before bedtime because I know I will probably sleep soundly.
Mm-hmm.
So that probably does suppress the...
Well, one glass of wine, we're talking now of greater quantities.
Well, even greater quantities probably.
Yeah, yeah.
But I find a pile of mold will give me wild dreams.
Of 6-inch, 3-inch ice cream cones? At least 6-foot, 3-inch.
What if you dream about prominent people that you, that you read about, but you get to meet them at a party and you're just talking to them as if they were friends of yours? Does that mean that you have illusions of grandeur or something?
No, perhaps you could turn it around and say that the quality this person has, this prominent person, is very important to you and that you want to get in contact with it. So if you're able to talk to them at a party intimately or closely or as a friend, you want to be closely associated with that quality that they represent, you know, whether they're politicians or artists or what, musicians, you see, depends. Nancy, I think.
Well, I have a question. About two or three times a year, I have sort of a recurring dream, although the setting's always different. But in the dream, I meet literally everybody I've ever known. And it isn't that they just pass, and no, never family, always other kinds of people. And they never pass in front of me like a parade. I literally have an exchange with each one of some sort.
Huh. How nice. I've never experienced that. That's kind of unique. I've never heard that.
Wow. It's wearing. I mean, I wake up tired.
You mean you stand there like Carter does? And
no, it's changed. I move through things. The most vivid one I had in Carleton College was the setting. One I was at St. Olaf College. I don't know why it was at Carleton. But literally, you know, people going in and out of doors and walking down streets, and I would meet them and talk to them, and all this would happen. It was literally about everyone I had ever known when I woke up and remembered the dream.
That is fascinating. Mm-hmm. That probably, did you dream this at a time when you were reevaluating your life? Was this sort of at important points, or could you?
That could be, but first time was when I was like a senior in college.
Uh-huh. About to graduate. It's yeah. sort of yeah. a, seems like that's when you might dream that, you know. At Easter, I have a ritual that I do where I actively do this, where I imagine each person I've known and so I have a little exchange, but I've never done it in a dream.
Well, that was the first time, but like I said, now I have it 2 or 3 times a year. That's what got me to help.
Yes?
Is there anything in our knowledge of dreams to indicate that people would dream the same dream? I know that there are some sayings, and I ran into this when I was in New Guinea, that very often students would have the same dream. And in one instance, as I think I mentioned to you a couple of days ago, they dreamt that a man was had awakened them,
oh, yeah.
had awakened one of them, and the other one, without conferring with each other, the other one told me, a man woke her up. Now, and I don't know whether that puts it in the realm of vision, but they have a saying there that if you turn the pillow over or something, that the one you love will dream the same dream. And I think that there are some other sort of old wives' tales kinds of sayings mm-hmm. that indicate that people will dream the same dream on the same night.
Yeah. I've heard these stories, but I don't have a confirmation or I don't have a theory to put on it. But I've heard that it happens.
Yeah. Claude Levi-Strauss, famous anthropologist. Well, anyway, he has a view about American Indians and others. In essence, is they'll have a tribal totem, such as the owl or the fox. And the question is it a tribal totem a fox that lives in a cave or a fox that digs a hole in the ground? The essence of it is their tribal life, he claims, is like that fox. There'll be people that do their hunting at night, and the whole. And when a young man is at a certain stage, he'll be asked to go into the woods and fast and come back and tell his dream. And if the dream does not include that burrowing fox, it is not a satisfactory dream. He goes back without eating until he finally has it. And so he says that many members of those tribes will have dreams, including that tribal totem. There would be a lot of repetition there. Yeah. Maybe.
I think in some cultures, to answer Carol, where they are more in touch, close to their unconscious. The more primitive the culture, the more in touch with the unconscious and with the myths. And if the myth is very strong, or the fear is very strong, as in that case, then it is quite possible for 2 or 3 people to dream the same dream on the same night. Because the unconscious cuts across time. Carol, back there? Oh, the other Carol.
I read a study that somebody did about that, where they would have somebody in a close room, say staring at a picture all night, and they'd have several other people sleeping nearby, and the results were really overwhelmingly in favor of that thing happening, because very often if somebody was staring at a picture of somebody climbing steps. You know, every one of those people would have some kind of dream about ascending or going upward.
And a lot of times
it seems that Paul and I have very similar dreams.
Jim and I have had similar dreams too. That is the frontier that I'd like to see much more research done in. Because it seems to me that when you're asleep and your consciousness is not operating, that you'd be much more open to this kind of suggestion and ESP and extrasensory perception. But that's a frontier that is not yet explored at all. And I think all the data we can get, we need on that area.
My husband says he doesn't dream very much, and I dream all the time.
There are differences, but mostly differences in remembering, because we all dream 2 or 3 times a night. But whether we remember them or not is just like our different personalities. But we can train ourselves to remember, yeah?
I had an interesting experience many years ago. I've never repeated it, but I had an interesting dream. I can't remember what it was, but it was just really, really good. But it chopped off before it was finished. So the next night I eagerly went to bed to see if I could continue the dream, and I did. And that happened for 3 nights.
Well, that sounds good. That reminds me of what this gentleman said the other day. He said, we dream like in a plot or a 5 acts, so that if you don't finish, you can force yourself to finish the dream. Again, we need more data on that. It would be nice if we could do that. I've never succeeded, really, in completing it.
Can you dream a certain kind of a dream of, like, say, a suggestion, like, I mean, just out of a conscious suggestion or out of fear? I mean, is that possible? I mean, can
you? Oh, that's usually what happened. Wait a minute. Out of conscious suggestion, no, I don't think so much. We don't have enough data.
Like you say, well, I'm going to go to bed and I'm going to continue this dream, or I'm going to be in this kind
of thing.
I mean, can you do that?
I don't know. I think that varies with the person, and I think we don't really know enough on that. Some people can, I suppose, just as some people can go to sleep faster. You know, there are people who hit the pillow, like my husband, and he's asleep. And many a time I've said, good night, dear. He says, you just woke me up. So, and I take half an hour to wind down slowly. And that has no relation to how we dream either. It's just, I think, it's a physiological thing, kind of.
Because your fears do.
Yeah, the fears,
much, express themselves.
Yeah, the fears that you're conscious, and mostly the fears that you're not conscious of. And the more you look at your dreams, the more you can become aware of what you're really afraid of way down there, which you're not even conscious of. Yeah.
One of the things that intrigued me a lot in the first part of the book was that they were talking about children's dreams, and children's dreams being as full of these symbols and this heavy stuff. And it's not like you start out dreaming childish dreams and you end up dreaming mature dreams. It's like you can get hit with the dream of a 70-year-old when you're four. That seemed really strange to me.
Then. Oh, well, why? Can you explain that view of what I said? See, the child is much more in touch with his unconscious because his ego is still very weak. He doesn't even have a shell around there. In fact, he may not even have an ego. You see? He hardly knows where he ends and the other person starts. You know, that's part of growing up. Building the ego is part of growing up. So when you don't have an ego, and the stronger the shell, the harder it is to get in touch. If you don't have an ego, you could dream way down here, and that's why some of the children's dreams are filled with archetypes, and that's why they love fairy tales. And that's why we must tell them fairy tales, too. Somebody made a study, was it Bettelheim?
Yeah.
That children who are deprived of fairy tales are really deprived, because they're not fed some of these vital images, and they contain so much wisdom and so much energy, so that it's important that they be in contact with, because that lives out for them what's in their unconscious.
Well, then, just recently I read about the fact that some people disagree about these fairy tales because they end so horribly, like the children pushing the
witch
in the oven, and that was not good for them.
Yes, but precisely why is it good for them? Because the witch image is in everyone, and the witch image has to be thrown in the fire, and they have to be able to do it in the fairy tale imagination and not for real.
What about the turtle and the eagle the other night in the story from South American culture? That didn't make sense to me.
Mm. Wait a minute. The which?
We had a Vesper's.
Yes, the eagle and the turtle?
Yeah, it seems to me that, I don't know whether the kids would. I question whether the kids would like the turtle getting splatted. She thinks, I mean, we talked about
it. Yes. Go ahead. Go ahead, please. I'm sorry.
That was my daydream. Yeah, that as we were going along in the story, we were identifying with the turtle.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why, you say for stories, little children can see soldiers getting killed, but if they see a little boy their own age getting killed in the story, it's horrendous. Mm-hmm. Well, I was wondering whether the children were so identifying with the turtle that when the eagle got there and he went splat, that wasn't very good.
Mm.
They probably thought he fell in the water.
On the other hand, Roger implied that he's told this story many times, and the children get a great satisfaction out of seeing that turtle get killed, because the turtle was trying to be something he wasn't supposed to be, and they get that message.
Of course, that's what he
tried to do. Yeah. And he implied that they got a lot of satisfaction out of it.
That could come from an Aesop's fable.
Uh-huh.
Of the turtle hanging onto the stick. Do you remember that? And he was so proud of himself that he opened his mouth and ruined it.
Oh, yes. Yes.
So it was a dog, I think, looking in the water.
Or was it the... That was a fox. No, it was a fox that was hanging... Holding, wait a minute.
That's the fox's passing chicken. That's Chanticleer and her blood.
Yeah. Can you just give it quickly as a...
The story is that Chanticleer the rooster is a very proud rooster and struts in the barnyard.
Yeah, he's proud.
Uh-huh. And the fox comes and says, would you sing that marvelous melody again and awaken the sun? And so Chanticleer stretches proudly forth and the fox comes up and grabs him and runs through the forest. And Chanticleer collects his wits and flatters the fox until the fox finally opens his mouth to answer. And then he runs up in the tree. Yeah. And the fox tries to get him back down. And Chanticleer says, no, I've learned my lesson. So,
yeah. That's similar. Yeah. Oh, the fables are beautiful.
I'm sure Chaucer was beholden to Aesop.
Yeah.
Or at least Le Fontaine or somebody.
I would say that go home and read Aesop's fables or fairy tales or mythology, and you will come across, and your psyche will be fed, and my, you will have fantastic dreams.
There is that side of us where humor has so much hostility in it, and Mark Twain's favorite story was it Elisha and the Bears or Elijah and the Bears? Anyway, this prophet was so angry because the children made fun of his long beard. So he said, if you make fun of my beard again, the bears will come out of the woods and eat you up. And make fun, the bears came out of the, he ordered the bears out of the woods and ate up the children. So Mark Twain's version of it was, the children did, he did, and the bears did. And the audience has just roared. It's such a primitive story. It's so silly in a way. And yet it acts out on the with its laughter, the side of human beings that, I'm not calling it a shadow, but the side of human beings is certainly not attractive. We laugh at such hard.
Why we laugh, what we laugh at can very often tell you what your shadow is. Think about that. What we really laugh at, you know, we go far, oh, you know. And so many jokes, like last night, did you notice how many jokes were bathroom jokes? And slightly sadistic jokes. Forget now who told the one about the one in the toilet. He got his behind blown off, and then he fell down, thrown down the stairs. That was hitting a raw spot for me. I could hardly laugh. But I wanted to ask you: have you read the book? Or do you have any questions? As you've been, I see you holding the book. Yeah. Do you have any questions on the book specifically? The first chapter is what we're concentrating on, and I'm talking around and about it. And everything except the types, which I'll talk about next week. Yes.
You mentioned a while ago the child has a strong, possibly no ego, and therefore he is very open to his psyche and able to dream, more clearly. And you talked about this as kind of an ideal situation, but we talk about adults as having strong egos, and this is good. Now, I mean, this is kind of the...
Just from the point of view of being able to dream readily these heavy dreams, in the world it's essential that we have a good strong ego, or else we won't get along out there. The person who doesn't have a strong ego is too sensitive, and there is something I'll bring up on Friday. That's the first thing I want to bring up, is what happens to the ego that is too sensitive to the unconscious. It gets kind of flooded and overwhelmed. You lose touch with reality. Or if you cut yourself off from the unconscious and are just in the conscious world, then you're living a very restricted life. So the ego must be somewhere in between and learn to be open to both. There's nothing that doesn't turn into its opposite, except Holden. Well, I think it's supper time.